Okay. Reminder again, your second quiz is Monday. So you need, if you're going to miss it, you need to let me know before the quiz. And so that's before 3:30 on Monday. And it'll be from 3:30 to 4. Right? Like the other quizzes, there will be class afterwards, so come prepared. So how was the case? It's over, right? Sunk cost. Hey, that's the first thing. It's over. Nothing you can do about it. And for those of you who did send your summaries in, thank you for doing it, because I think by my estimate, there are 612 people in my two corporate finance classes, the MBA class and this one. Roughly speaking, there are about 4.5 people per group. You're saying, who's the half a person? Well, you know what I mean, 4.5 person on average. So it's divide 612 by 4.5, you get about 140 groups. The reason I'm taking this long road home is I asked you for summaries, and about 75 of you sent in your summaries, right? Which is not bad. I mean, that's about what it is every semester. So I'm going to show you what you found, but I'll tell you one thing even before I show you the numbers. 75 of you sent me your return on capital, your cost of capital, your NPV finite life, your NPV longer life, right? No two groups had the same number on any one of those four variables. No two groups match up cost of capital, no two groups return on capital. And that was no surprise, because as you discovered to your frustration, as you were working through the case, I left you room in some places to make your own judgments. That was intentional. I didn't tell you, for instance, what the life of the server is, and you kept emailing, what's the life of the server? And I said, make your own judgment. And what I wanted to see is, and that's what I'm going to be checking as I go through, is whether you can make sensible judgments. Because that's the way the real world is. There are lots of data you will not... If every problem came with every parameter given to you, I don't need you. I could just pump the numbers into a computer, pump out the answer, it would be an autopilot. So the reality is, when you do corporate finance, when you do valuation, when you run a business, you will get to those spaces where things are not specified and you have to make your best judgment. You cannot get paralyzed. You have to make your best judgment. So there will be differences that come from those judgments. Some judgments are more sensible than others. Okay? You're saying that's your subjective view. Hey, I grade, so my subjective view overrides your subjective view. So that's the reality of this power sharing agreement. So I will make a judgment looking in answer. I'll tell you what an unreasonable judgment would be. You get to that server and you say, well, I'm going to depreciate it, okay? You capitalize it, you have to depreciate it. You don't have a life. You say, I can assume whatever I want. And you assume a three-year life. You know why that's almost indefensible here? You have an old server that you're still using, right? That you expect to use for the next 10 years. So at the minimum, your server has to have a 10-year life. So if you're using a three-year life, you can't say, well, you didn't give me a number so I can make up any number. Any number won't fly. And that's something you're going to run into as you go through and you make these judgments. So you're going to see my analysis of the case, not the analysis of the case. Okay? So before you freak out, your number is different from mine, there will be room to disagree on numbers. And we'll talk about what that acceptable disagreement is, what happens when you go off the reservation. So let me start off by giving you what I found on the case. The cost of capital I ended up with for the Netflix studio, and I'm going to be very specific about it because that's what you were asked to assess, is this a good investment for Netflix, was 10.56%. And I'll come back it up with how I got to 10.56%. But they do have cost savings they create for the rest of the company, right? Remember that for the U.S. operations, actually, that they saved $30 million? The cost of capital for those cost savings is different. Okay? You're saying, oh my God, our case just blew up. If you look at the last two pages of the packet today, you'll actually see my grading template. Okay? That'll actually tell you what I will be taking points off for, what I will not be taking points off for, why. And there's a little, if you look at the last column, it'll say 1A, 1B, 1C, 2A, 2B, 2C, 9A, 9B, 9C. When you get your case back, on the front page of the case, you will see your grade for the case. And then right below it, I'll say issues. Don't get freaked out by the word issues. The issues will be those points on the case where I think you didn't do what you're supposed to do. So it might say, you got an 8.5, and the issues were 7A and 9B. You're saying, what the heck is 7A and 9B? If you look at the last few pages, it'll tell you what I think 7A and 9B are. And I'll tell you why I do this. When I was in business school, I used to hate cases, absolutely hate cases. Why? Because when you got a grade back, you couldn't contest it. So the professor would say, I didn't like your analysis, 7. What didn't you like about it? I just didn't like it. What does that mean? I don't like it. So in this case, if you see a grade, you will see why I gave you the grade that you did. And I also want you to be able to then come back and say, you know what? I did deal with 9B on page 755 of my report. That might be the problem, is you got to 755, I didn't get there. But it might be that you did have it in your report, and you can say, well, you missed that there. So I want you to be able to see where I think you missed on the case and whether I might have screwed up on that. So as we go through this, there will be places where your numbers will be different from mine. If they're different, if you want to see what you might end up losing on the case in your final, just look at the last two pages. It'll give you that indication. Okay? So those are the costs of capital. And the reason I said that is if you look at the very last point on the very last page, cell 10 for synergy. What am I saying about how many points I'm going to take off if you use? I'm not going to take off any points. Why? Because I know it's a small number. In this case, it's not, and I don't want to make a big stand on this. But it is, in fact, a conceptual issue. When you have two sets of cash flows with different risks, you should be attaching different discount rates. Here's what I saw in terms of numbers. The return on capital I got for this particular studio was 27.94% without counting the savings to the U.S. operations. It is slightly higher if I count the savings, so obviously I get more income. The net present value that I get using a 10.56% cost of capital is $386.22 million, the finite life case, the 10-year life. And the present value of the cost savings adds another $123.42 million, giving me a total net present value of about $500 million in the finite life case. In the infinite life case, I got a much higher net present value, $1,008. Actually, let me back up. If you remember the wording for the case, the first one said use a 10-year life. Do you remember what the wording was for the next part? It just said longer life, right? I'd say you don't have to use a perpetuity. You could have gone an extra 15 years, 20 years, 25 years. I chose to go with the perpetuity, and most of you probably did, but that was not required in the case. You could have just said, hey, studios don't last forever. Technology changes another 20 years. I'd have been okay with that. Yeah? With the perpetuity assumption here, I get a $1.888 billion net present value, and the present value of my cost savings also increases because of this project lasts forever, I keep saving more money in perpetuity. So that's the $228 million, total net present value of $2.1 billion. The IRR exceeds the cost of capital in both cases, but there is a little issue in the cash flows that should make you a little wary about the IRR, right? Which is, there are two sign changes. In year five, for many of you, there's a negative cash flow, which means I computed the IRR, but I said, you know what, no, if I have to use it, I'll use it, but it's higher than the cost of capital. But the net present value is going to rule. Given those numbers, I would accept the studio investment. But I'm going to say something even more stringent. Even if the net present value had been close to zero, maybe even a little negative, I might have still accepted this investment. Why? In fact, let's build on that. With the studio, I have 65 million international subscribers by the end of the 10th year. Without the studio, I have 47 million international subscribers. You're saying, so what? You counted the revenues from the subscribers. Do you think Netflix, there's value to Netflix from having a lot of subscribers, which is not captured in these cash flows? How many of you are Netflix users? It's a little creepy if you ask me, when you open Netflix and they say, you might like all these other shows. That's the first creepy part. And the creepier part is, it's actually true. You say, how do you know? And the reality is, Netflix collects information about you as you watch, about what you like to watch, what you don't like to watch. That's when you heard the words big data thrown around a lot. You know what big data really means, right? Amazon knows a lot about you, Netflix knows. But knowing by itself is not the big issue. They can use that knowledge to actually make money off you. So how can Netflix use that information? Not only does it determine what shows they buy for their content, because they say, hey, these shows are watched a lot. But remember, they're building a studio in Mumbai, right? What's the studio going to do? Make shows. Based on what? Based on what people like. They have an advantage over the regular studio companies because they have feedback. They know they can tweak shows to make them more acceptable to you, attractive to you. That's an option to expand that they're going to get. So even if this project had been a neutral project, if it is a bad net present value, I wouldn't have taken it. But even if it's a neutral project, just the fact that it expands the subscriber base is a good thing, which I can potentially use elsewhere. But that wasn't even an issue. My net present value itself was positive, so I could build on that. So let me take you through my cost of capital computation. There are two separate costs of capital I have to compute. One is a cost of capital to apply to the cash flows I'm going to get from the new studio I'm building. Studio business is not Netflix's conventional business, so I can't use a regression beta, the beta against the, so basically, whichever beta I run, it doesn't make any difference. It's not the beta that applies if I'm looking at the studio business. So I went into that spreadsheet of movie companies. I took the median regression beta, so basically I did what I did in the Disney case. I took the median beta, unlevered it, came up with an unlevered beta corrected for cash for being in the movie business. So think of that as being the beta for being in the movie business. I got 1.16. Now, you can get different answers if you use the average, if you did the unlevered for each company and did the median. So the variation, it's not going to be huge, but I think you get betas as low as one, depending on how you set it up. And you can get beta slightly above 1.16, maybe to 1.22, depending on how you work with that spreadsheet. But you're looking at just movie companies. Everybody clear on why we're doing that? Because this is a project in the content business. It's not Netflix's conventional business, which is streaming and make money of streaming. This is a content investment. That 1.162, I have to lever up to get a beta for Netflix. To lever, I have to use a debt-to-equity ratio. And for this, I'm going to use Netflix's debt-to-equity ratio. Why? What did I say in the case about debt that leads you to go back to the company? After all, I said the company doesn't matter. In fact, I said specifically that it's going to use the same mix of debt and equity as it does in the rest of the business. I could have phrased that differently. I could have said Netflix is going to use all equity on this project, in which case you'd have just used the unlevered beta, come up with the cost of equity, made it to your cost of capital. But because I said it's going to use the same mix of debt and equity as in the rest of the business, I had to estimate what that debt and equity were. The equity was easy. Share price times number of shares gives me $37.5 billion. The debt was a little complicated because it came in two parts. One was interest-bearing debt, which is off the balance sheet. I think it was like 2005-17. I don't know what but I did compute the market value, but this was one of those cases where even if you didn't compute it, not a big deal because it's very close to fair market value. That's the interest-bearing debt. What's the other debt? Commitments, but not just operating lease commitments, but contractual content commitments. Do you understand what those content commitments are? You open up the Netflix page, you see all these movies, right? You see TV shows. How does Netflix get the right to carry these? They have to buy the rights to these shows, and when they buy the rights, they sign 3-year agreements, 4-year agreements, 5-year agreements to pay Disney or Warner Brothers or whoever the owner is for the next 3 or 4. That's what those contractual commitments are. They're just like lease commitments. They're contractual commitments. The present value that I got for those commitments was $10.31 billion. Now, I was looking through some of your PDF files, and I did notice some of your present value of lease debt was 13.5, was much higher than mine. The reason, the very simple reason for that is there was a latest year, and then I gave you the next 5 years, right? It's a timing issue in cash flows. It's a very messy issue. Last year is gone. It's done. So if you count that as part of your lease commitments, you're going to end up pushing up your lease commitments. Again, this is not one of those issues where I'm not going to take off any points, but keep that in mind. When you do your project and you compute the present value of lease commitments, it's all about the future. What's happened last year in 2015 is irrelevant. It's not a commitment anymore. It's already been paid. So the present value of my commitments is $10.3 billion. What discount rate do I use to discount those commitments? The cost of debt, pre-tax or after-tax? Why pre-tax? You're right, actually, so don't freak out. It is pre-tax. Why pre-tax? Because the commitments are pre-tax commitments, right? Those commitments that you see in the table are pre-tax. It's a simple consistency rule. The commitments are pre-tax commitments, so I discount them back at a pre-tax cost of debt. That's a $10.3 billion. Again, let me pause. Any questions up to there? That gives me a total debt, if you add those two, of $12.75 billion, which gives me a debt-to-equity ratio of 34% and a debt-to-capital ratio of 24%. That 34% debt-to-equity ratio is what I use to come up with my levered beta of 1.3994, or 1.4 if you want to round it up. That is going to be my beta for the studio investment. I plug it in to my cost of equity. I get a risk-free rate plus beta. Oh, here there's I have to pause. The equity risk premium I have to use for this project should reflect where it does business. It's true the studio is in India, is in Mumbai. Why am I not using the equity risk premium for India? If the studio is in Mumbai, why am I not using the equity risk premium for India? Yeah, Roy. That's not the reason, though. Yes? In other words, it's not like the subscribers fly to Mumbai and watch the shows there. They produce the content there, and then it goes into TVs across the world. And the distribution, basically, is every part of the world that Netflix is in other than the U.S. So the weighted average equity risk premium across the regions of the world that this studio will be bringing in subscribers is 7.95%. That becomes the equity risk premium, which gives me a cost of equity of 13.13%. So risk-free rate in dollars, that's the only place the dollar matters. Because I use dollars for my risk-free rates, remember what inflation rate I make you use. You have to use an inflation rate in U.S. dollars. So the currency choice affects my risk-free rate. It affects the inflation I build into my cash flows. If I did everything in rupees, all that would change is my risk-free rate will become a rupee risk-free rate. And all of my inflation rates would then have to be Indian rupee inflation rates, which would be much higher. Yes?
Why is your marginal risk premium for the cost of equity to Netflix
6%?
Because wasn't it?
No, wait. That's above the line. So let me come below that. So for the cost of capital for the studio, it's 7.95%, which gives me a cost of capital of 10.56%. That is the discount rate I'm going to use for the cash flows in the studio. Now there's this small slice of cost savings that they're going to get, right? Where are the cost savings going to be? Entirely for their U.S. operations, right? The equity risk premium that I used for that was 6%. Before you freak out, what did I say? How many points did I say I was going to take off for not doing this? Nothing. So let it go, right? So if you use something else, it's okay. I just want you to think through risk when you think about cash flows. I'm using the equity risk premium for the U.S. because the savings are entirely in the U.S. And the savings are not to the studio, they are to Netflix as a company in the U.S. So I switched back to the beta for Netflix for that. That gave me a cost of equity of 12.5% and a cost of capital of 10.09%. So what I'm doing is separating my synergy cash, those cost-saving cash flows from the rest of the cash flows, because they're coming from two different places, have two different risks, and therefore deserve to have two different discount rates. Any questions on cost of capital? Now, do you want to see what you found? Before I show you this graph, though, remember, these are the numbers you sent me. So don't ask me how come that number is so high. It's not my fault. It's your number. So basically, you don't like a number, take it up with whoever gave me that number. Now, I don't even know who that is, so no, it's anonymous. So I looked at the cost of capital you sent me. Remember the law of large numbers? It's working. The median cost of capital is 10.55%. I got 10.56. So right around the middle, we agree. In fact, that's where the bulk of the cost of capital are, between 10.5% and 11%. Maybe you have some wide variation. There's one group that said their cost of capital was 4%. There is zero chance that this is right. Absolutely none. So if you're the group that turned in 4%, there is no conceivable, we talked about differences in assumptions, there's no conceivable way you can get to 4%. Something has gone horribly wrong in your calculation. I don't know what it is. I'll let you know when I see it. Okay? At the other extreme, there is one group that claimed that the cost of capital is 15.03%. Again, I have a serious, I don't think you can get up there. You could use different groups of movie companies. Maybe if you use Netflix's beta with 7.95% plus, I don't know what risk-free rate, maybe you can get there. I have a really tough time getting up to 15%. But again, those two extremes suggest that something went off kilter somewhere along the way. But the median cost of capital is about 10.55%. So we have our discount rate. Let's turn to the interesting part of the analysis. Let's start with accounting earnings. I made you start there because I wanted to torture you with all the issues that accountants have to deal with, and this is part of the reason, is I want you to think of how many little things you had to wrestle through to get accounting earnings, because that's what accountants have to do. So I'm going to show you my estimates of accounting earnings and the judgments I made along the way. So to build up my accounting earnings, I first had to come up with the incremental revenues on this project, right? There are two ways you can get to incremental revenues. One is the long way and the other is the short way. Here's the long way. You can do the revenues for the studio without the, I'm sorry, for Netflix without the studio, and the revenues for Netflix with the studio and take the difference. That's a lot of work, right? Because you have to build up the total revenues for the entire company with and without the studio. And if you do it right, you should get the right number. But there's a much easier shortcut. You know exactly what the studio creates, right? What are the two additional sources of revenue you're going to get because of the studio? Come on, the case can't be that far in your memory. Roy? New subscribers, new studio subscribers, right? The 5 million in year one building. So that's one. What's the other? The second is your international subscriber growth is higher with the studio than without the studio. That difference doesn't seem like much, right? 3%. It's 3% in year one, but what happens over time? It compounds. So in year one, the difference is tiny. You're saying for this I'm building a studio, 32.5. But by the time you get to year 10, look at the difference. It's almost 16 million more subscribers because you have the studio. So those are my two sources of revenues. That goes into my starting line. My incremental subscription revenues is the sum of those two. When I do my cash flow tables, I prefer to have them compact. That's just my preference. I did look at some of your tables, and you break line items down into 6 line items, and by the time you're done, you have 40 line items on a page. That's okay, but my suggestion, this is just a modeling suggestion, is have the details in separate worksheets and have one page where everything comes together so you can see what's happening. Because then you can see strange things. He said, that doesn't make sense. What's happening in year four? So my revenues are my total incremental revenues. My costs of servicing these subscriptions are $48 for the international subscribers and 60% of that for the new studio subscribers. So the sum of those costs is right there. So There's my cost of subscription. The depreciation is $80 million. You know why, right? It's $1 billion. Salvage value is $200 million. It's straight line. You say, what happens in year six? I'll come back and talk about it. There's a jump in depreciation coming from something else happening in year five. But the $80 million is kind of a constant across the 10 years. The G&A, I tried so many different ways of wording it, but every single way that I thought about wording it, people read it in strange ways. So I'm going to let it flow. What I really wanted you to do, and some of you obviously didn't get this, was when you did accounting, I wanted you to think of the allocated G&A, because that's how accountants deal with G&A. They allocate G&A. And when you did your cash flows, I wanted you to think of incremental G&A. Somewhere along the way, people started adding the two numbers. So I did see a few projects where the G&A in year one is the allocated G&A plus the incremental G&A. If you did that, your operating income is going to be lower, but our cash flow should be the same. You see why? Because once you start cleaning up. So I'm not going to make a big deal about what you show as G&A on your accounting earnings, because I can understand maybe you read that bullet to be both things get charged to the project. I read it as saying, because I wrote it, was so clear to me. It always says. I just read it as saying the allocated G&A goes into operating income, so there's my allocated G&A. That's 10% of the total G&A of the company. Why is the accountant doing it? Because that's what accountants do. They allocate. Then there's the advertising expense. I subtract that out. I come up with my operating profit. In year one, I have an operating loss on which I show a tax benefit. So what am I assuming Netflix is going to do with that loss in year one in the studio? We talked about this in the Disney theme park as well. When you make a loss, what are the two things you can do?
You get a tax benefit. You can use the tax benefit.
How do you get a tax benefit right away? What do you have to do? The IRS will not mail you a check for 40% of the loss, right?
So either you have like negative net income, or because of this loss, it reduces your net income.
In other words, you need in. Does Netflix make money elsewhere?
Yeah.
So if you make a loss on this project, what are you going to do? You're going to consolidate. You report taxes as a company, not for the studio separately. So I'm assuming they will be able to claim the tax benefit right away. So that's a tax benefit right there. There's my after-tax operating income. So there's my after-tax operating income every year for the next 10 years. Any questions? Now, there are subjective judgments that affect my measure of operating income, and it's going to show up in my return on invested capital. I'm going to compute a return on invested capital, but what goes in return on invested capital? The after-tax operating income is the numerator, but I need an invested capital in the denominator, right? Invested capital for a project is not like invested capital for a company. You can't take book value of equity plus debt minus cash. It doesn't work. Projects don't have balance sheets. So the way I had to build up invested capital is to decide what to put in there. And in my invested capital, here are the three things that show up. The first is obviously the studio that I invested, the book value of the studio. So that's going to be in there, right? And that's going to decline over time. The second is the working capital that I'm going to require for this project. So that's going to go into capital because that's money tied up. And the third is starting in year six, I'm going to allocate 20% of whatever I invest to get the server. You're saying, why 20%? Why not? It's an allocation. You're saying, that's pretty cavalier of you. I knew walking into my accounting return on capital calculation that this was not what I was going to base my decision on. So if I sat there and spent 6 days saying, should 20, 25, 30, it doesn't make a difference ultimately. So I'm going to make a decision here and move on because, again, you can base it on what capacity each uses and try to make some allocation mechanism. It's almost arbitrary. Right? And how you depreciate that server is obviously going to affect the operating income as well. I assumed a 20-year life. Why 20? Well, if you want to use 10, I'm okay with that. No, 15, it doesn't make a big difference overall in my cash flows. So I used a 20-year life. And I use straight-line depreciation rather than accelerated depreciation. Why? Why do I want to make my life complicated? You want to use accelerated depreciation, be my guest. Again, I'm not going to stop you, but I made 20 years of straight-line depreciation. So here's what my return on capital looks like for the project. In the second column, you see my studio operating income, and obviously it's a loss in year one. There's my cost savings from the U.S. And I've computed return on capital both based just on the studio income and on the combined income, because I wanted to see how much of my return on capital is coming from those cost savings in the US. In my book value, I have the studio, I have the working capital, and I have the server starting in year 5. There's my average book value, and not surprisingly, it declines. Why? Because it's a finite life. In the initial return on capital, I'm using a 10-year life, and as the project gets older, the book value of the project declines because I'm depreciating it. My return on capital, not surprisingly, climbed from minus 2.75 to 161%. So I have different returns on capital. I want one number. The first thing I did was I computed a simple average. The problem with the simple average, you can already see, is the end years have these huge returns on capital that are pulling up the simple average. So here's a trick I find useful whenever you have a problem like this, when the numbers kind of change over time. I added up the entire studio operating income. I came up with 2,111 million over 10 years. And I divided that by the total invested capital. In other words, I added all the numbers for the 10 years. I call that my aggregated number. It's like a weighted average number. That's basically what it does. It looks across time and says, on a weighted average basis, and that's the number that I think is a more reliable number to focus on. And based on that number, the numbers look pretty good, 28% return on capital without the savings and about a 31% return on capital with the savings, which is, they're both significantly higher than the 10.56%. But as I said, this is not what I'm going to base my decision on. But if I were basing it on accounting return on capital, it's going to look pretty good. Anyone see the numbers you came up with? Your average return on capital is about 20%, not unreasonable. The median was about 18.8%, not unreasonable. There's one group that came up with a minus 34% return on capital. I'll guess that what you have is a problem. Your operating income is an operating loss, and the only way you end up with an operating loss on this project is if you forget one item of revenue. You see what I mean? In other words, you forgot one. It can happen. I'm not going to be saying this is the end. I will grade the rest of your case on the assumption that you just missed it, right? That's why you're getting negative. But that should have been a clue. If you get negative, 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 would I ever put together a case where everything is negative? I mean, what's to decide, right? So that's the only way you can end up with this negative number. Were you the minus 34%? No, okay, good. So let's get that out of the way. Yeah. Well, it's not process. It's every single issue there is a conceptual issue.
Right, so if you've got similar numbers...
If the numbers look okay and conceptually you screwed up every step of the way, you will lose points because I can't give credit for randomness. The only reason your numbers look okay is you forgot something in the denominator, something in the numerator, you can end up with roughly the same return on capital, but that means absolutely nothing, right? So if you make conceptual mistakes, I'm going to say that's a conceptual mistake. You have to deal with it. You can't tell me my answer is close to yours. That's not good enough. It is about, because a conceptual issue is going to blow up on you in another project somewhere along the way. Okay? Randomness is not going to work in your favor every single time. That's why I'm saying I'm not checking to see if your net present value is close to mine. Your net present value could be very different from mine, but conceptually you got almost everything right except you forgot the revenue part. That's a big deal, right? I would still take off only a half a point. So everything about your case is perfect, but you forgot one big slice of incremental revenues. I'd still give you a 9, or 9.5 even, because this is not about finding an Excel line that you forgot. Maybe that's all that happened is when you added things up, you forgot a line. Now let's talk about after-tax cash flows. There's my after-tax operating income from 2 pages ago. I've now introduced a new column that I did not have in my operating income, which is column 0. And I want to say something about this column 0. There is no year 0. There's a time 0. The reason I say that is year 1 is actually a year, 365 days. Year 0 is a point in time. It's now. So when we say year zero, we're talking about spending money right now. So if you look at year zero, there is a capex of $1 billion. They're saying, what about the $150 million test marketing? It sunk, but shouldn't I be including it in my invested capital and then taking it out like I did for Disney? Why? I mean, the Disney theme park was all over the place, if you remember. It was in my initial investment. It was in my depreciation. I had to do all kinds of contortions to get it out of the process. What does this case tell you about the R&D that makes your life incredibly simple? What did I say? First, it was $150 million? I said it was already spent. And I did. There's one word in that bullet that actually was what made your life easy. Let's see if you remember what that word was. No, that's always true of a sunk cost. That was true even of the test marketing or whatever, the licensing that Disney paid. That's always going to be the case with sunk cost.
It's been expensed.
So who cares? What does that even mean? There are two things you can do when you spend money. You can expense it or you can capitalize it. When you expense something, what happens? You show it as an expense that year, and then you move on. When you capitalize it, it goes in your invested capital and starts depreciating over time. In the Disney case, the $500 million that had been invested in the theme park had been capitalized. So I had to worry about my invested capital and clean up for it, and then add back the depreciation, because that depreciation is going to be there anyway. Here, because it's been expensed, you can actually forget about the entire bullet point. It's as if it didn't even exist. It really doesn't show up anywhere because it doesn't affect your invested capital and obviously doesn't affect your cash flows. So all you have is $1 billion initial investment. And then I have a change in working capital showing up today. Why? What did I say about working capital that makes it show up today? That the investment has to be made at the beginning of the year, right? So if I need to have $31.06 million as my working capital at the end of the year, I need to actually make the investment at the beginning of the year, which is right now. So my changes are always going to be 1 year ahead of my actual number. So I compute. So that's my working capital each year. What's this minus $218.28 million at the end of the 10th year? What happens at the end of the 10th year in the finite life case? I shut the project down. I basically sell the studio for whatever's left, which is the $200 million salvage value. I have all this working capital. Let's say it's film, whatever I use to make film. I don't throw it out into the street. I sell it for cost. This is my way of wrapping up things and saying, I'm done. I'm going to salvage my initial investment. I'm going to salvage the working capital. So that goes into my final year's after-tax cash flow. And those are my cash flows for the next 10 years. One little correction, adjustment I have to make. When I did my operating income, I used that allocated G&A, right? Which we know is not the real G&A. The allocated G&A is right there. Right below it is the actual incremental G&A, the G&A caused by this project. So if you look at year one, what did I do? I subtracted out $42 million, the allocated G&A, when in fact I should have subtracted out only $40 million. In other words, I've subtracted out $2 million more than I should have, because I went with that allocation mechanism, which means my income is too low. So what I'm going to do in year one is add back the effect of the G&A. So when we add back G&A, that's all we're doing is we're correcting for that difference. And in the first 2 years, I'm going to make my operating income higher because I'm replacing a higher G&A with a lower number. In year three, the process turns. My incremental G&A becomes higher, and it keeps getting higher. So if you look past year three, my operating income is overstated because I use the allocated G&A. So I'm going to subtract out the additional amount to get to the correct cash flow. You know how you can avoid this whole issue? Just do the operating income with incremental G&A. You don't have to do this correction. You see, I couldn't do that because I had to do a... There's no reason why you can't do two operating income tables, right? One with the allocated, one with the incremental, and use just the incremental amount. When you do the cash flows, you'll get exactly the same answer that I do. So that's my after-tax cash flow. There's one other issue. If you look at the server investment, there's an investment in year five. You recognize that, right? Why do I have to invest in year five? Because I ran out of capacity in year five. So I'm sure everybody had an investment like that or something like that in your cash flows. But then you keep going across, and there's actually a negative investment in year eight. What's going on here? Let's focus on the server effect. Okay? Remember the two questions I asked you to ask whenever you have to think about incremental cash flows? I said, what will happen if I take this project? What will happen if I don't take this project? Let's carry those questions through. If I take this project, I run out of capacity in year six. I actually chose to invest in the previous year because I don't want to wait till the end of the year that I run out of capacity, because somewhere in the middle of the year I'm going to have a problem. But if you made it year six, that's fine. But for me, I made it year five. So that's what happens if I take this project, if I invest in year five. But I'm not quite done. What happens if I don't take the project? Well, there's my capacity usage without this. You know what? I'd have run out of capacity in year nine. So without the project, I'd have invested in year eight. With the project, I invested in year five. So what's the effect of this project? It's not that you invest in a server, but that you invest in a server earlier than you otherwise would have. What you're capturing is the present value difference. That's what I've done. By leaving this cash flow as my CapEx, I'm offsetting it by the savings I'm now going to have in year eight because I'm not investing in a server in year eight. And I've got to complete the story. If I invest in year five, I get another benefit, which is I start to depreciate that server quicker. So what you have here is my depreciation starting earlier rather than later because I make the investment earlier. So that becomes part of my benefits, the tax benefit from depreciation. So what happens after year eight? Well, in year eight, I'd have made the big investment anyway. So my depreciation tax benefit also goes away. In fact, it gets to be negative because I'd have had an even bigger depreciation tax benefit with the more expensive server. Yeah. You are. You are, right? Where do you think these cash flows go? What do I do with these cash flows? No, but hang in there. Why am I doing these cash flows? Discount them at 10.56%. So what happens to them?
The way you're cashing is you're saving money by buying the server earlier.
Right.
But also you could have invested that money.
That's exactly what discounting does for you. If you do it again, you'll be double counting, right? So when I discount these cash flows, what's going to happen? The 650, 46 is going to get discounted back 5 years. The minus 676 is going to get discounted back 8 years. It is going to show up in the net present value. You can do it separately. In fact, when I did it separately, I came up with a minus. So that's my present value effect. I could have just put that in my initial investment. That's the other way you can do it, is take the difference, show it as part of your initial investment. You don't have to leave it in the cash flows. I prefer to leave it in the cash flows because I want to see my cash flows as they actually exist. Yeah. When in my notes did I say the risk-free rate? The net present value approach uses the cost of capital.
Always cost of capital.
Right.
But in terms of like the interest that you could have saved in those time periods, do we assume that you could reinvest?
So all cash flows are operating cash flows. You have to use an operating cost of capital. These are operating decisions. They're not guaranteed, right? You don't know that you'll run out of capacity in year eight. You expect to run out of capacity in year eight. It is risky. So it's not guaranteed that you have to invest in year five versus eight. It's a lot of uncertainty. You could have to invest in year four rather than year five, in year seven rather than year eight. You got to use a risk-adjusted discount rate for that. Somebody back there had a question? Right. So the net effect of having to make the investment earlier is going to be only minus 70 million. That's what your net present value is changing by. Right? Any questions on? So, yes. Page 10, yep.
Can you explain the changing working capital year zero?
I just did. Somebody help me out here. So why am I making an investment in year zero? Because I need 31.06 million for the revenues in year one. That's what the case says, right? That's the total working capital. It's 10% inventory, 5%. No, so you work out. That is the total working capital you get. Now, you can see it works out to what, 9% was the net amount, you know, when you work it out. If you take the revenues in year one, you can actually see what the working capital is going to be. So it's whatever that 345 million is times 9%, which is the 31.06 million. Okay. Is your question about the magnitude or why it's in year zero? Okay. So the 31.06 is the 9% of revenues. That's the working capital I need. That's for year one. But if you read the rest of the bullet point, what does it say about when the working capital investment has to be made? The beginning of the year. What's the beginning of year one? What's the beginning? If I ask you, take the next 365 days, tell me when they begin. It's kind of a silly question. They start right now, right? So the beginning of year one, so when you say year one in a present value table, it's the end of year one. So the beginning of year, so if I put it into, in here, I'm assuming that I can make the investment at the end of the year. That's the significance of the beginning versus the end of the year statement, is it moves your working capital, you know, forward 1 year if you can make it at the end of each year. Okay? So that's the working capital change. Any questions, any other questions about the finance? The tax benefit on what? Yes. For the cost of debt that you're talking about?
No, like when your income statement at the end is negative and then you said you get a tax benefit, how do you compute that?
Oh, just the tax rate. Just the tax rate times whatever your loss is. So if you have $100 in losses, your tax rate is 40%. You'd say 40% of $100.
Okay.
So it's the same tax rate. The same way you, so it's in fact your Excel spreadsheet formula doesn't change. It's just a negative number times 40% instead of a positive number. So it actually makes it convenient. You can use the same equation. It takes care of it for you. Okay? Any other questions on? So now I'm ready to do the NPV and the IRR. So now I can take care of Justin's point, which is where's the present value effect? It's going to show up and I do the discounting. So I take my cash flows and notice that there is a big negative cash flow in year five now because of the server investment. And a big positive cash flow in year 8 because I save on the server investment. I discount them all back. I get a net present value of about $386 million for just the studio cash flows. But those cash flows I discount at 10.56% because they represent the risk of the studio. That's the cost savings done separately. Why am I doing this separately? Because I know I'm going to use a different discount rate on them. Now, if you incorporated them in your regular cash flows, you are using one discount rate for all your cash flows. As I said, I'm not going to make a big deal about that in this case. It's not a good idea to combine cash flows from different risk places in one consolidated cash flow. So these cash flows I discount back at the 10.09% cost of capital that I estimated for the cost savings because they're all in the U.S. and they're to Netflix as a company. So my net present value from that is $123 million. You add them up, the total net present value that I get in the finite life case is $510 million. You guys look a little shell-shocked. Okay? So let's see what you found. The median net present value, again, was very close to mine, $442 million, $410 million. The lowest net present value probably goes with that minus 34% return on capital because that would make, you know, if you have negative income, of course, your cash flows are going to be negative, minus one. There was one group that claimed that the net present value in the finite life case was more than $2 billion. Which, you know, I don't know how you get that now. So I'll check the numbers. Maybe there's something in there I should be looking. Maybe a salvage value number that's off. But that's the net present value with a 10-year life. Any questions on the finite life? Yep. Once. Oh, you mean two signs. Well, earlier, zero to one, and then...
One,
yeah.
Year 6.
Yeah.
Doesn't that make IRR less reliable?
Yeah, that's why I'm not basing my decision. I can still compute an IRR, but I'm not basing my decision on IRR. I'm basing it on NPV. Yeah. Now let's talk about the longer life. Yes?
Can you explain the bottom item on slide 11 one more time, the effect of the
Well, just... isolate these are the cash flows, right? Minus 646 in year 5. The tax savings in year 6 will be 32.32 times the tax rate. So get the tax savings in those 3 years. Plus 676 in year 8. So just have just an Excel spreadsheet with just those. Take the present value at 10.56%. So that'll be the present value of investing earlier rather than later. So that's a negative number. Offset partially by the fact that you get tax benefits for those 3 years. Of about, what, $10 billion, $12 billion a year for between years 6 and 8. So that's the net effect of both investing earlier and the depreciation tax savings. But it's just those last two lines, just isolated. It's already in your NPV. You don't have to do it, but that's what's happening. When I compute the NPV of all of these cash flows, that's how much it's... So if you ask me what would have happened if you'd never had the server, You just have to add 67 million to that 386, and you'd get the net present value with no server at all in this game. Okay. Now let's talk about what happens when you extend the life. Let me first tell you what you cannot do. You cannot do what you did for the first 10 years for the finite life. Wake up on the last day of the 10th year and say, well, I'm going to make this project last forever. Saying, why not? I'll give you an analogy. This might not quite fly, but hang in there anyway. Let's say your objective is to run the New York City Marathon when you're 65. Good, no, good mindset to have when you're 65. You cannot wait till your 65th birthday and say, you know what, the marathon is in 2 weeks. I'm going to run it. You've let yourself go. You're 500 pounds overweight, your cholesterol is 350, your heart's ticking, you know, not regularly. You're going to die on that marathon. So if you want to run the marathon when you're 65, you've got to start behaving as if this is what you're going to do when you're 55, right? Like running every day, keeping yourself in shape. You see where I'm going? If you want to run your project into the ground over the next 10 years, you can run it into the ground. You can just take all the cash flows and depreciation, not put any money back. And notice I didn't put any capital maintenance in my 10-year life. I don't see the point. What's the point of maintaining something if you're going to shut it down? I mean, maybe you can have a sliver of maintenance. But I'm not going to be maintaining this project, investing back $100 million every year for the next 10 years if I'm going to shut the damn thing down after 10 years. So I'm going to behave very differently if I decide that this project has to last for a long time. Behave very differently right from the beginning. So let me explain what I did differently with the longer life. Up to the third line item, I did pretty much what I did in the finite life. But then when you get to CapEx, notice in addition to the $1 billion in CapEx now, I'm now putting money back in each year. Why am I doing it? Because I need to be able to run a marathon at 65. I need to start thinking about what do I need to do to keep this project going so that cash flow that I get in from depreciation, which is what that plus 80 was, I say, you know what, rather than take it out and take it as a cash flow this year, I'm going to put it back into the project. You're saying, why that capital maintenance? Let me explain how I came up with the capital maintenance. I know accounting depreciation is not the same thing as economic depreciation. Accounting depreciation is what you put in your financial statements. Economic depreciation is the depletion of your asset. It's getting older, it's getting less efficient. But over time, the two have to converge. So here's what I did. I said, let's assume that the accounting depreciation is what my asset is depleting by. I've got to make up. In other words, I've got to replace old assets as they come due. But I can't replace them with what I originally paid. When I did my accounting depreciation, I based it on today's cost, which is $1 billion, and I depreciated down $80 million a year. To replace that $80 million asset a year from now, I have to spend more than $80 million. Why? Because there's inflation. So in year one, I took the $80 million, I added the 1.5% inflation, and I put in capital maintenance, which is slightly above inflation. And as you get through time, as I get to year four, year five, year six, as inflation builds up, my capital maintenance continues to build up, but it's always done relative to depreciation. Partly because of the economic rationale, the depreciation measures what my assets are losing in value, and partly for a very mechanical reason. Remember when I did invested capital in my finite life case? How did I come up with that invested capital? I start with the original CapEx, then I subtracted our depreciation. So they kept falling. When I replace the depreciation with CapEx, what am I doing to my invested capital? I'm keeping it intact. In fact, I'm making it grow over time as inflation continues. So when I get to year 10, I hand this project to you. Not only will the assets look pretty new because I've been maintaining them, but if you look at the capital invested in this project, it's going to be higher than the $1 billion up front because I've essentially kept the project healthy and growing because I want to hand you a healthy project. So that's what the capital maintenance is. Now you say, I don't like that approach. I'll give you a second way you could have got capital maintenance. You're investing $1 billion right now, right? Let's say you're one of those people who lets the things run down. You get to the end of the 10th year, you change your mind. You want the project to keep going. You've got to replace the entire studio now. On an inflation-adjusted basis, that's going to cost you $1,160 million. That's $1 billion with the inflation built in. you can think about how much you'll need to set aside each year to get to $1,160 billion. Money's not going to grow on trees by the end of the 10th year. The annuity you need to set aside each year for the next 10 years to get to $1,160 billion is about $71 million a year. Why is it so low? Because it learned money. So you put $71 in year one, in year two, year three. That's at the cost of capital. There I can accept different ways of estimating what that annuity is. You might say, look, I need to put in a risk-free account. The amount's going to get higher. But essentially, that becomes your basis for thinking about continuing this project. And in this case, because this project goes on forever, I can't salvage working capital. I can't sell off my assets because the project keeps... It's inconsistent to sell off working capital and keep the project going at the same time. So what you will see in year 10 is a terminal value that captures what happens after year 10. It's a trade-off. You see what the trade-off is? When I go from a finite life case to a perpetual life case, you will get lower cash flows for the next 10 years. That's bad, right? But I give you a higher value at the end. You think, why can't I get the cash flows that I got in the finite life case and the higher value? Life doesn't work that way. You have to decide whether you want to run your project as a finite life project or a perpetual life project. And those, the net trade, the effect of that trade-off is positive, because at least in this case, because my net present value jumps to $1.88 billion for the studio and $2.116 billion overall, if you include the savings continuing forever as well. Okay? So here's what I mean by the trade-off. There's my finite life cash flows. There's my perpetual life cash flows. That's one of the things I'm going to check when I look at your case, is whether those cash flows, if you have the same cash flows in both cases, and a high terminal value in one and a salvage value in another, hey, it'd be nice if we can pull that off, but that's not viable. Okay? So what I'm looking for is, are you treating the finite life case and the perpetual life case differently from a capital expenditure standpoint? So I'm not. So if your CapEx is different from mine, I'm fine with that. I just want to see different assumptions driving the two scenarios, because you have to have different assumptions about capital maintenance. And the trade-off here is you settle for lower cash flows during your 10-year period to get a higher value at the end. Any questions? So here's what you found. The median net present value is about $2.6 billion. Again, not that different from my $2.2 billion. The average is $3.3 billion. The lowest net present value, minus $74 million. Probably that same person who found the minus 34% return on capital. So this will flow through. If you messed up on a revenue line item, this is where it's going to show up. The highest net present value is $17.1 billion. If that is right, Netflix will double its value as a company by taking this project. Right? Again, I don't know what you assume. I'll make a guess as to what happened. And here's the way to think about this. This is something that is not just for this project. It's a constant in finance. In valuation, you see this, where you have to make assumptions about what happens after a point in time. So I'll tell you how to think about consistency. If you assume the project ends, then basically there is no or very low capital maintenance, because you're going to end the project and you're going to get salvage value at the end. If you assume the project continues forever and you set the growth rate at 0%, you're allowed to do that, right? I didn't force you to use a growth rate at all. If you say, look, I'm just going to have level cash flows, then you can actually assume that capital maintenance is equal to depreciation beyond the 10th year. Why? Because you're just maintaining your invested capital. You're maintaining operating income. You're actually shrinking in real terms. You're not even growing at the inflation rate. If you assume that you will grow at the inflation rate, which is what I assumed, then I need to have capital maintenance be higher than depreciation, because I can't count the good stuff in my revenues and not count it when I think about capital maintenance. And finally, and this is where I think you get the $17 billion net present value, if your growth rate in perpetuity was higher than 1.5%, you have a little bit of a problem. Do you see what the problem is? What did I say about your studio by the time it gets to your end, year 10? It's at full capacity. What does that mean? If you let your growth rate be higher than the inflation rate, what are you doing? You're bringing in new subscribers. You're letting the base grow. If you do that, you need to invest in a an additional studio, not just replace the old studio. So now I'm looking at year 10 saying, hey, you used a 3% growth rate forever. Good for you. But where's the investment? This is, it might seem like a little nitpicking point. It is the central issue in lots of discounted cash flow valuations. It's a reason company valuations often blow up, is people making inconsistent assumptions about growth and reinvestment. So my decision was to take the project. It's a good project, and subscriber base is going to be added value. Out of the there were 75 groups that responded this morning. Three had blank in the recommendation. I hope that that's not what I see in the final report. Blank is not one of the options that I thought I gave. Hopefully it was just a mistake. Of the 72 that suggested action, 62 suggested accepting the investment. 7 suggested rejecting the investment. 3 said other. I am not sure what other is. But guys, don't stop acting like sell-side equity research analysts. They can put out weak buys. Have you tried a weak buy? I actually bought 1,000 shares of Valiant just 30 minutes ago. I was going to hit a weak buy. I'm not feeling that good. I'll hit the button slowly. Maybe that's what a weak buy is. But after I hit it, I still have 1,000 shares in my portfolio. There are no weak buys and weak sells in the real world. You either invest or you don't. You either jump in the water or you don't jump in the water. You don't just stick your toes in and say, I'm in the water now. It doesn't work that way. Okay? So if you're one of the others, hopefully you had it fixed by the time the final report comes out, because I don't want to see this final section where you say, on the one hand, on the other hand, on the third hand, on the fourth hand, and you be the fifth hand. Okay? This is about making decisions. And I know there's uncertainty. You have to make assumptions. But do you think that's going to go away with any business decision? So what will happen is I will first grade the MBA class because they're early in the morning, not because I like them more. Okay? And I grade sequentially, which means I start with the cases that came in first and I work my way down the list. I have about 65 MBA cases. Hopefully I would like to get them done by tomorrow, and then I would start on you sequentially, starting with the earliest cases. So you will start getting your cases back probably in the order that you sent them. So if you sent them at 10:29, and there were about at least 15 cases that came in at 10:29 this morning, that's cutting it really, really, really close. Okay? You will be last in line, and there are about 6 of you who tried to be clever. I think there were 3 that said, so studying in the studio, you decide to put in your own nifty little things in there, studying in the green studio, the red studio, the blue studio, the Mumbai studio. It's a smart mailbox. It doesn't recognize smartness on your part. It calls, basically, you do something with it, you're going to end up in my regular mailbox, which means you're last in line. So after I've graded everybody, I'm going to go looking. Basically, I go look at 1029, 1028, 1027, and I'll find you eventually, but you'll be the last person. So if you sent it with the wrong subject, I would suggest you resend it again with the right subject. I'll know you sent it ahead, so at least you'll get into my regular sequence, and I'll get back to you. But the reason I asked you to CC everybody in the group is when I send you a graded case, it'll come back as an Acrobat file with my notes in little Acrobat comments. And on the front page, you'll have the grade and the issues that I saw in your case. And I'll send it back to all of you at the same time. So it'll be a reply all. I don't use reply all. That's not my default, but I reply all. So all of you should get your graded case back at the same time. And then you can all freak out at the same time if you want to. I don't know. Beyond that, it's out of my control. Okay? So any questions? I know we're at the end of the class. I have 5 minutes, so I'm going to set up what's coming next after the quiz. We talked about the trade-off or the debt and equity, what those choices are, and how every business has only 2 ways to raise money. They can borrow the money or use their own money, debt or equity. What we're going to be spending time on next week and the week after is that trade-off. If you're a business, what are the benefits of using debt? What are the costs of using debt? And obviously, I could say the obvious. If the benefits exceed the costs, you should borrow money. If the costs exceed the benefits, you shouldn't borrow the money. So I'm going to go through first. The way I'm going to set it up is I'm going to set it up as a qualitative trade-off. What are the pluses and minuses? But I first want to make sure that you don't fall for what I call the illusory benefits of debt as opposed to equity. I've heard CFOs say that debt is better than equity because it's cheaper. It's cheaper in what sense? The cost of debt is lower than the cost of equity, right? Does it make it cheaper? Mathematically, it looks like cost of debt is lower than the cost of equity. It should be cheaper. Why is the cost of debt lower than the cost of equity? And how do you take on, when you say you take on, as the equity investor, why do you take on more risk? In fact, every year when you get cash flows, who's first in line to collect from those cash flows? The creditors. Who's last in line? Shareholders. If the guy who's first in line wants to make a 7% rate, and you're the last guy in line, you should ask for more than 7%. So it's a given that the cost of equity is going to be higher than the cost of debt. It doesn't make debt a better way of raising money than equity. Because when you borrow money, you make the equity investors feel even more risk. And the more you borrow, the riskier the equity becomes. So if the only reason you're borrowing is because the cost of debt is lower than the cost of equity, please stop. That's not a good enough reason. So I want to talk about legitimate reasons for borrowing money. But one of the legitimate reasons is not that it costs me very little to borrow money. So let me at least set up the trade-off. There are two big benefits of debt, and this should sound very familiar, the first benefit at least. The biggest benefit of debt is our tax codes are skewed towards debt. Barring sections of the Middle East where this is not true, in much of the world, when you borrow money, I give you a tax advantage. How? When you make interest payments, they're tax deductible, but cash flows to equity have to come out of after-tax cash flows. So that's the biggest benefit of debt is a tax benefit. That's a pretty, you know, easy benefit to see. The tax code is written in such a way that debt is, so you borrow money to take advantage of the tax code. There's a second benefit of debt, and this is a little more subtle. In some companies, you can argue that forcing managers to borrow money can actually make them more disciplined about the way they pick projects. That sounds like a strange thing to say. But in some companies, it is true. Having that obligation to meet every year of interest payments will actually make managers think more seriously about what happens if I take a bad project. It's an extreme way of getting managers' attention, but in some companies, borrowing money can make managers a little more careful about how they pick projects. Those are the two big benefits. There are three costs that I worry about when I borrow money. The first is a bankruptcy cost. What's a bankruptcy cost? Well, you could go bankrupt. And the more money you borrow, the greater the chance of that happening. I don't care who you are. You could be ExxonMobil and make a ton of money. But if you borrow another $10 billion, your risk of defaulting just went up relative to what it was before you borrowed the money. That's the biggest worry you have when you borrow money. What if something goes wrong? You think nothing can go wrong? Think about Valiant. Stock was at 250 2 years ago, year and a half ago. Today it's at 28. 27.15 was what I got my 1,000 shares at. Why is it so low? Because it's got $30 billion in debt, and people are really worried about the fact that if it doesn't file its 10K before April 29th, it's technically in default, and the bondholders can take it over. I don't care what its assets are worth. In a sense, it's flirting with default. That's the bankruptcy cost. The second cost is an agency cost. What's an agency cost? Anytime you have two groups with different interests, you have an agency problem. In this case, you have equity investors who want to do what? They're going for upside. You know, they worry about downside risk, but they also care about upside. And what do lenders care about? Making sure they get paid. It's all downside risk for lenders. There's really very little upside they get. So if you let lenders run companies, they will never take risky projects. What's in it for them? So that's a conflict of interest. We're going to see it play out when you see decisions made by companies that borrow a lot of money. And finally, every time you borrow money, you give up some future flexibility. It's nice to have excess debt capacity just in case you need it. Something bad happens. And you borrow money, you give up that flexibility. So let's talk about the tax benefits of debt. There's simple ways to see what the tax benefit. You just saw that when we did the cost of debt, right? When you borrow money at 5%, after taxes, like borrowing money at 3%, that 40% tax rate saves you money. You can actually compute it as a dollar value. Every year you have $100 million in interest expenses, you're effectively saving $35 to $40 million in taxes because of those interest expenses. So the higher your tax rate for any given level of interest expenses, the greater the tax benefit of debt. What does that imply? If you have a high tax rate as a company, you should borrow more money. So let's think about why there are differences across tax rates and countries. One is you go geographically across, you know, go across the world. In the U.S., the marginal tax rate is close to 40%. In Ireland, it's close to 12.5%. If you're Ryanair versus United Continental, two airline companies, you would expect United Continental to borrow more money than Ryanair will simply because the tax benefits of debt to United are so much higher than the tax benefits to Ryanair. So if you're working with five companies in your group from different countries, this might be one of the things you want to look at. What are the marginal tax rates in these countries? Because holding all its constant, higher tax rate countries should have companies that borrow more money. Last page, and then we'll end for the day. If you look at some segments of even within the U.S., you have this very interesting game play out. Real estate in particular. There are two ways you can structure a real estate business. The first is as a real estate corporation, which means it's a regular corporation with taxes filed like a corporation. The other is to set yourself up as a real estate investment trust. A real estate investment trust is a pass-through entity. What does that mean? When it makes money, it doesn't pay tax on the money. It passes the money through to its stockholders. It's required to pay 95% of its earnings as dividends. So real estate investment trusts do not pay taxes, and real estate corporations pay taxes like a corporation. Holding all else constant, given what we just said about tax rates, if you compare the debt ratios of real estate corporations to real estate investment trusts, which one should have more debt? Real estate corporations have more debt because they get a bigger tax benefit from the debt. Real estate investment trusts get a benefit, but only in terms of pass-through interest expenses. So you should expect real estate investment trusts to borrow less money than real estate corporations. So think about taxes. And when we start after the quiz, we will continue with the other benefits of debt and the other costs, and we'll see if we can bring them all together in a framework for answering the question, how much debt is too much debt?
Specific examples, then you're going to run into roadblocks. It's not just so. Every project is going to have items that are unique to that project that you've never seen before.
Exactly. I don't think most people have.
That's why we have the case.
How much are the
grades? It's
10%. Just like the grades.
Yes. included in their interest payment, it's included as an obligation of balance. So the 2,435 that I showed you, they actually capitalize a portion of their amount. That's why I just gave you the interest-bearing debt and said, let's do it right. Okay, right? So if I've given you the 4.8 billion, then, and if you'd added the 10.3 billion, that would be double counted. But I gave you just the interest-bearing debt.
And we're assuming that all of the contractual obligations they've worked on the criteria. Yeah? All right. Okay. Yeah.
Why do you not use the
because it needs to be transferred.
Our question was we expense the server capacity in year six.
Do you, you expense it, you didn't capitalize it?
We didn't capitalize it.
Okay, and see, then you showed the savings and expense in year eight?
Year nine.
So you don't have the depreciation, so it'll be just there. It'll be 645 Dr. 1 minus T and 676 Dr. 1 minus T.
And also, why don't you use pre-tax the 5%?
The only reason it showed up is because it's always going to be ignored. The reason you had to clean up for it more rigorously in the DT part was because it was always capitalized, which means it showed up in the investment capital. And it was depreciated, which meant it showed up in your depreciation, so you had to do a lot of cleaning up to get it out of the process.
But if we capitalize, you know,
that's not a choice, right? Because I told you. You kind of override the facts on the case.
Do you know when and where the recession is tomorrow?
Oh, it's sorry, I actually moved it to Friday because it turns out almost no one's going to be ready by tomorrow. So what I'll do is I'll send out, I just to get a room for Friday, so I'll send out.
Can you
cite
that
you because I was trying to avoid the 12 to 1 all sizes problem. Classes running from 12 to 15, 7.
Yeah.
2:30, 3:30 I thought might make more sense because your class at 3:30 and it was the basic.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
And by then, people might have had a chance, at least, to look at some of the things that would actually make more sense.
Yeah, cool.
I had a question about evaluation. Because I watched your class with screen and you were doing evaluation class, right? And you were doing different evaluations and self-evaluation. So, like, it was a different, assets, and you guys on the place. So, how do you...
We actually did a little bit of... when we did the Disney value breakdown by business movie month.
Yeah, I remember that.
That's a pricing of each part. You add up those parts, that's like a pricing, a relative valuation sum of the parts. Right, with this.
Okay, so, yeah, I mean,
or you could do an intrinsic valuation. You take each business and then we have to do this kind of cash flow valuation.
But, like, my question was, how do you, I was listening to the video, and you're looking at the multiples of EV, like, single sales, EV, invest capital. Mm-hmm. And you said that you looked at the, you picked the one with the most explanatory.
Yeah, because I looked at the cost of the sector and then
how did you run the revision?
The cost of contribution to the sector. Right? Yeah, yeah. The big company and the mitigator.
So you ran against the comparables and then, like, whichever one's the highest, and highest are screened to see the other thing.
Yeah, I just had a basic question about the review session, but it's all positive. Well, because it was like, yeah. We got our cost of capital at a, it was like 5.76.
Why did it so low?
Because we included U.S. in the
but that's
equity
right.
risk premium.
But you see, equity risk premium should still be 6.something% with the U.S.
Yeah.
So if you have a beta above 1 and a risk-free rate of 2%, that actually should push you up to a 10, 11